Hello, beautiful people. My guest today is Jonathan Hillis, and he's on a mission to increase the GDP of the creator economy. He's building creator cabins, a community of remote cabins for remote workers near Austin, Texas. He has a community called Capital.community, which is an online community. He's got the Creator Fellowship, and he previously was the director of product for Shoppers at Instacart. So all that goes to say, Jonathan is an incredibly bright and wise individual who has been through some of the challenges of life, the challenges of burnout, the challenges of creation, and we explored it all in this episode. If you have any thoughts or feedback about the episode, let me know on Twitter. At Hey Danny Miranda is the best place to do so. And just wanted to say thank you for listening, for giving me your attention, and I hope you guys enjoy my episode with Jonathan Hillis.
Interesting people, thought-provoking conversations, nutrition for your brain. Journey through the minds of the world's top performers and discover what it really takes to achieve your highest version. This is the Danny Miranda Podcast.
So I figured we'd start things off with building your first website on GeoCities. What was that like? How'd that come to be? And explain that story.
Oh man, I love that question. I haven't been asked that before, but in fifth grade, I had this friend, and for some reason that I think kids just get really into certain things, and I was really into Halloween with this friend. We would deck out his whole front yard with these crazy Halloween, we'd spend the whole month of October working on building props and lights and all this stuff to scare the neighborhood kids on Halloween. And so we made a Halloween themed website. And it was had these, I'm sure you remember that era of websites that had lots of sort of dancing pixel art pumpkins and stuff like that. And that was really my gateway to the internet. I went on with that friend we ended up making a bunch of videos that I think we started making them before YouTube existed, but then, eventually started posting them on YouTube when that became a thing. It was just this magical world where you could, even as a kid, build things and share them with the world in a way that really got me hooked on the internet.
What'd your parents say?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think that my dad is a pretty early adopter of technology. He's a professor, but he was first exposed to internet in the internet in the 1980s when it was sort of used for academic purposes. And he would tell me that he was about the first time that he received an email from a company. And he thought that was just the greatest violation of the internet he'd ever seen. And he wrote to the company and said, this is not what the internet's for. It's not, I'm never going to buy anything from your company again. Because at that point it was just academics. And, I think it obviously has become much bigger and better than that since then. But I think my dad still has a little bit of a yearning for the 1980s academic internet. But as a result, yeah, he was very supportive and kind of understood, what I was trying to do.
That's awesome. And so he believed it was a violation because they were trying to sell him something.
Yeah, exactly. At that point, the internet wasn't really used for commercial purposes, and it was just academics sending, papers back and forth. And he just thought it was this egregious idea that you could use the internet for selling something.
And so you mentioned that you were creating videos with a friend. What were those videos about? Halloween as well, or something else? Man.
Yeah, there's all sorts of stuff. I can dig up one of the most popular one, that we posted on YouTube, which I guess is not surprising because the internet loves weird stuff. And this was the weirdest thing I have ever made. And it'll give you like a real glimpse into my, you know, fifth grade or so brain. But it's set to this very strange song called Bath Time in Clerkenwell. And it was when we were first playing around with Flash animation and learning how to do that. It was that era when Flash animation was everywhere. The sort of like E-bombs world type stuff. It was just all the goofy, weird things that came out of our brain. And we, you know, would download pictures from the internet and animate them and have these like creatures talking to each other. I think there's almost certainly some Halloween stuff in there.
So it was just to fuel your creation? Like, what was the reason for creating it?
Yeah, you know, it was really just for fun. This was before... That's awesome. Internet distribution was really even a thing. There was no social media to go post it on. I think when we first made this, I don't think YouTube even existed, or if it did, we hadn't heard about it yet. And we just wanted to make stuff, you know. We would just sit around and make these weird animations and videos and show them to our parents, and like that was good enough. And then once you were able to start putting these things online and distributing them, you know, we thought that was magical because it was like, wow, like 10 other people, you know, saw this. And at this point it was just our parents. So like we consider that a big win.
Totally. So what happens after you create your first website and then eventually you go to high school or middle school? What's the next layer of your internet citizenship like?
Yeah. So I think the thing that was the next real breakthrough for me was discovering online communities in middle school. And, you know, like I said, at that point, it was really just us kind of putting something out there just for the sake of creating it. But then by the time I got to middle school, you know, I found Dig and kind of an early version of Reddit. I also was a super nerdy kid. I was on these like science Olympiad message boards for these like, you know, science competitions I was in. And I made a lot of friends and posted a lot on those message boards. And that really opened up this idea to me that, oh, this isn't just about making something. This can be about meeting people and, you know, joining and participating in these communities. And that was a really big breakthrough for me. And actually ultimately was the kind of inspiration behind the first startup that I started, which was an online community for thought-provoking conversation, which it turned out, you know, I both knew nothing about how to start a startup, and that is not a very good idea for a startup, or at least wasn't then, because it's not really a niche. It's not about anything. And, you know, now I actually think I've been very fortunate to invest in some much better, you know, founders than I was, who are building things like the Interintellect, which really are these sort of fully formed online communities for thought-provoking conversations. But the one I made did not work. And so, you know, I decided to go to a real startup and learn a little bit more about how to build a company.
Yeah, I want to get into all that. But before I do, I want to get to you traveling around the world, and specifically getting dragged out of a bar in China. Could you tell that story?
Oh my God. Wow. You did your research, man. You really pulled up all the fun parts here. Yeah. So, you know, I went after I graduated from college. I had all these airline miles saved up. I had spent a year as the national chief of the Boy Scouts of America, where I, you know, basically spent a year of college traveling around every weekend and going to these local scouting events. And so I had a tremendous number of airline miles, but I had not had a chance to study abroad in college because I'd been doing this Boy Scout stuff. And so I cashed in. Delta had this deal. I don't think they still do, but you could cash in like 300,000 airline miles and get an around the world ticket. And you, as long as you started and ended back in the same place, and there are a couple other rules, you could, you know, go anywhere. And so I spent that summer traveling around the world and doing the sort of classic like blitz tour. I had a friend who was doing a Fulbright fellowship in China. And he was studying dams and the impact that they had on waterways in China. And it turned out to be actually a very controversial topic because the Chinese government was building a lot of dams, but they were impacting these like local native communities in China, and the government didn't really want that to be published. And so I show up in Kunming, which is still a huge city, but not one of the largest cities in China. And I go to his apartment and he pulls me aside and kind of whispers to me like, "Hey man, like, just so you're aware, I think my apartment is bugged." And I was like, "What? Where am I? What's going on?" And he was pretty stressed about it, but he's like, "Yeah, you know, I've been here a while. Like, I can't really do my research. They've confiscated a lot of stuff, but we're just going to like have a good time and go out to some bars." And so we did that, and it was a wild experience. We went to these, crazy bars in Kunming, had a lot of baijiao, which is a terrible drink I would not recommend. I'm in this bar and I started trying to talk to this person. And I didn't realize that whoever this person was, you know, they were not somebody who was supposed to be approached by, you know, some white guy that didn't know them. And I was trying to, you know, it was a younger woman, and I was talking to her, and all of a sudden from behind her, these two dudes walk out, you know, in like bulletproof vests, and basically just like grabbed me and just dragged me out of the bar. And I don't know to this day who that woman was, but I know that she was not somebody who, you know, random foreigners were supposed to be talking to.
That's hilarious. But wait, so what happened with the bug department? Did you ever figure out if it actually was bugged or why he thought that was the case?
You know, the thing about China, and I feel very fortunate to have gone when I did, because this was, this would have been 2013. It was right before, you know, the big mobile apps started blowing up in China and completely changing. You know, everybody got mobile phones in the couple of years right after that, started using them for payments and started using them for everything. And this was right before that. And so I got to see, you know, a glimpse of kind of the last bit of China before it was really transformed by technology. And, you know, I'm sure this is still the case to a large extent, but certainly at that point in time, China was still a place where crazy stuff happened and you just didn't ask too many questions about it. And so, you know, I also like I was on an overnight bus that got pulled over, and like these police officers and aviators came on the bus and started yelling at everyone in Chinese. And like, I have no idea what that was. You know, I don't know what happened with the bugs. I don't know what happened in the club. Like these sort of things, this was just what happened in China.
Did you feel uncomfortable by it, or just the way that was the way it was?
You know, I think that just was the way it was. I had the fortune of coming from a family where, you know, my dad and his brother and sister all grew up in the Democratic Republic of the Congo in India and Nepal as kids, because my grandfather was researching hepatitis for the United States Air Force, because they were starting to use chimps in the space program, and they wanted to make sure that the chimpanzees in the space program weren't going to infect humans with hepatitis. So he was out in the jungles, you know, doing this research on chimpanzees. And so as a result, you know, I come from a family where there's a lot of crazy stories like this, where, you know, they just grew up in places where they were in the Congo during a revolution, and they just had to get on a, you know, tiny plane and fly out and leave all their stuff behind. And like stuff like that just were the types of stories I grew up with. And so I think that gave me a real comfortability with just going around the world and having some crazy adventures.
Wow. Okay. So you come back to the United States, and is that when you build this community for people with to have thought-provoking conversations?
Exactly. Yeah. So I got back and actually spent about, I didn't even make it to a year. I think it was like 10 months at a company, you know, kind of traditional company in Chicago, pursuing a very traditional career path. And I was just like, what is this? This is not for me. Oh my God, what am I doing? Left after 10 months, you know, moved out to the Bay Area, lived in this ramshackle house in Oakland with some of my best friends from college. And we tried to, you know, we were trying to recreate the kind of college experience. We wanted to take the amazing conversations that happened, you know, in the dorm room late at night. And we thought we could bring that onto the internet. And it turned out we had no idea what we were doing, but I certainly feel like we learned a lot along the way. And, you know, I think that experience both led me to want to go to a more established company, and then also really planted the seeds of wanting to build online communities and be a part of online communities that sort of reference back to my time in middle school.
Yeah. So you go and you decide you're going to look for a job, and you create this extensive spreadsheet where you list companies. And I'm curious, what was on that spreadsheet and what were the key attributes you were looking for?
Yeah. So I was in this position where I felt like, okay, I'm in the Bay Area and like, this is my chance. I've tried doing a startup. It's clear. I have no clue what I'm doing. I need to, you know, kind of take the classic tech advice to find a rocket ship and don't ask which seat and get on board. And so I knew that's what I wanted to do. And I just started trying to research every possible company that was in sort of the Series A, you know, basically seed through Series B stage. So kind of like early mid-stage companies that I thought had a really strong growth trajectory. I did a ton of research. I built a spreadsheet. You know, So of course, like any, you know, it's sort of like being a venture capitalist, except you have to put all your eggs in one basket, right? And like any venture capitalist, I only remember the winners from the spreadsheet. I'm sure I could go find it, and I'm sure there are lots of companies that, you know, haven't done as well. But I do know that near the top of the list of the companies I was really excited about were, of course, Instacart, where I ended up. Because I thought that the on-demand economy and was going to be tremendously large and important in the future. I also was very excited about Stripe. They were, at this point, I was living in the Mission, and they were just around the corner from my apartment in the Mission. And I remember hand delivering my resume to Stripe. You know, I walked around all over the city taking copies of my resume and just like, because I had no real background or in, you know, for tech. And I just knew that I had to really demonstrate high intent. So went to the Stripe office and handed them my resume. And unfortunately, you know, never heard back from them. But I also, let's see, where else? Flexport was another one that I went to their office. And they just like, I walked in the front door. Stripe had a receptionist. Flexport, I walked in, it's just like a bunch of desks sitting there. And I just like walked up to somebody and I was like, hey, I want to work here. And they just looked at me like, what am I supposed to do to help you with that?
What gave you the confidence and or initiative to walk into the front door of these buildings and hand your resume to these people?
You know, it really, it's nice of you to call it a confidence. I think at the time it felt maybe something more like a desperation. Like I just knew that this was the path I wanted to take. And I knew that I didn't have the network or the qualifications to, you know, make it through the traditional avenues. And so I just knew the only way I was going to make this work was to, you know, go above and beyond to demonstrate that I could do something different than the other candidates. You know, another one that a company that I'm still great friends with their founder and CEO is HipCamp. And HipCamp had a real special place in my heart because they were building this cool platform for that was both going to support landowners and also support people looking for camping opportunities. Based on my, you know, scouting background, it felt like a really personal fit and connection. And I spent hours preparing for my HipCamp interview, you know, and I was interviewing for a job way, you know, above my qualifications and pay grade, because there was like a 4-person company and they, you know, that was the type of jobs they had. But I just like, I remember walking in with a binder full of research that I'd done on the camping industry and on landowners, and, you know, really trying to convince Alyssa, the CEO, that, you know, I was the right person for the job. And that was just how I was approaching all of my my job search at that time, because I knew I needed to get my foot in the door somewhere.
And when you were looking at identifying these rocket ships, what were the attributes that you're using to identify this is a company that's going to succeed?
Yeah. You know, it's a good question, right? It's the trillion-dollar question of venture capital. And I'm certainly no expert. I've had the advantage of both seeing some of that on the inside and also now being an investor in a number of companies. You know, my perspective on this is actually that at the very early stages, it's incredibly hard to tell. And it's honestly a bit of a crapshoot when you're looking at, you know, pre-seed and seed companies. But once you get to Series A, Series B, there are some pretty compelling signals, you know, for companies that are going to be successful. You can really look at a founder and understand, is this the type of person, you know, that has the drive and the willpower to make this happen? You can look at the early team. You can look at, you know, the industry, and if you really believe that this is going to be something tremendously big and valuable in the future. And Instacart certainly checked all those boxes for me. I think, you know, it was very evident early on that Apoorva, the CEO and founder, was a guy who was just going to push down walls, you know, to make it happen, was just going to do whatever it took. He had tried like 20 startup ideas before Instacart. And he likes to talk about the social network for lawyers he tried to start, you know, which like is just not a good idea because lawyers don't want a social network. They're pretty private people about their work. But he just tried everything, right? And he, you know, he also likes to talk about how he locked himself in his apartment to like get the first version of the app finished. And he didn't want to grocery shop until he could do it with the app that he built. And so he just like sat down and he's like, I'm not going to be able to get more food until I finish this thing. that's the kind of drive that it takes to build these very, very successful companies.
Yeah, that makes sense. So you get hired by Instacart, and how does that journey take you over the next, 6 years?
Yeah, exactly. You know, I really did take the mentality of find a rocket ship and don't ask too much about which seat. And I ended up starting at Instacart in a role that was essentially just it was the lowest rung on the totem pole. It was a role where basically just whenever something went wrong, in real time, we had to figure out how to solve the problem. And it went through a number of different, you know, iterations of names over the years, I think. But for most of it, it was called logistics operations. And the way that it worked was there was a page called the status page that at least lore goes that, you know, it was designed by Apoorva and coded by Andrew Kane, the first engineer at Instacart. It still exists as of at least when I left. But it's a page that just shows all of the orders in real time, you know, all the shoppers, all the customers, all the times. You can click into things and figure out what's going on, see how orders are batched together, see what, you know, items are being picked, see maps, all these things. So that was my main tool for my first year of the job. It was literally just, I would scroll through all of the orders happening at any time, which luckily at that point was like still a feasible thing to do by hand. And I'd look at the status page and, you know, I just try to figure out at that point the kind of core logistics system is about how many orders do you take in, where and when, how do you batch those orders together? Right. And then, you know, how do you assign them to the right shoppers and get them completed? And all of that stuff was to put it gently, run by very naive algorithms that did not work all of the time. And so, you know, literally my first job was like batching orders together, right? Like trying to figure out how to make sure, oh, we told this customer we can do this thing. Okay, how do I find a shopper, you know, that's here that could also take this extra order and send it to them and get, you know, it was like, I was doing that for like sometimes 12 hours straight. And you know, the hard part about that was it was incredibly exhausting work. I'd get up at, you know, 5 a.m. Pacific time because we would open at 8 a.m. on the East Coast. And then I'd work through all day. But you know, the great thing about it was I learned the entire business. I knew that business inside and out. I knew how all of the core logistics systems worked. I knew how the catalog worked. I knew how shoppers worked. You know, I knew how growth worked. I had some deep intuitive understanding of the business after doing a year of that, that really set me up for a jump into product management, which is where I spent the rest of my career at Instacart.
You just mentioned you understood how growth worked. What did you learn about growth from that experience?
Yeah. So marketplaces are, I think, the kind of most interesting kind of business because they have these complex supply demand dynamics that are really at the core of the growth engine. So traditional growth is about, you know, optimizing funnels, getting people from the landing page to sign up to buying things. And that stuff's interesting and you can run cool experiments there and you can optimize it a lot. And I learned a lot about that. But what I found to be most interesting is the supply demand dynamics and how that impacts growth. And so, you know, the sort of core problem for these on-demand companies is actually mostly a supply side problem, or at least in high growth periods is a supply side problem, which is that if you don't have enough shoppers, you can't take more orders. And so, you know, a lot of my time at Instacart, which I think started with that work in logistics operations, but really extended through my whole career in product there, was about figuring out how do we get more shoppers? How do we make sure the shoppers are in the right places at the right times? How do we open up availability so people can get their groceries right now? Because if you can't offer them a delivery right now at this moment, you know, they're going to bounce. And we used to call that a lost delivery. Right. And once you lose a delivery, right, they're just going to go to the grocery store and get it themselves.
Mm, yeah, that makes sense. So you switch and go into product, right? Or you don't switch, you just go. How does that happen? How do you get that role?
Yeah. So, you know, I think like any, well, I shouldn't say any, but certainly many product managers, it was a roundabout and circuitous path that, you know, I think now a lot of the bigger companies, they have these associate product manager tracks where you can sort of start out and learn the ropes. But I think the best way to get into product is just to go find a role at an early startup. And there's so much work to do. There's always more work than people. And if you can demonstrate competency, you know, people will pull you in to help. And so for me, that path was actually through marketing. So, Instacart was in this high growth period and, there was a 2 or 3 person marketing team that, all left the company right around the same time. And, all of a sudden there was no marketing team, no institutional knowledge. The last guy said, I'm giving my 2 weeks notice and, you know, basically, that was it. And so they very quickly looked around the room and said, you know, who do we think can do this? And for one reason or another, they selected me. And so I had literally a week and a half with the one remaining guy on the marketing team to learn the ropes. He was out the door and I was all on my own. And at that point, we didn't need to do a lot of consumer marketing because the demand side of the business was growing, but we really needed more shoppers. We needed to do supply side marketing. So that was my primary focus. And I remember I spent 6 months, you know, just going in at the crack of dawn every morning, staying late. I had a whiteboard where I tracked, I think we were in 13 markets. And I had, you know, trackers for each of the markets and how we were doing on shoppers and how we were getting people, you know, through the marketing funnel and job boards and all, you know, all the different platforms we were using and how they were performing. And I mean, it was just an insane 6 months of me with a computer and a whiteboard, just like frantically going back and forth, trying to find enough people to deliver groceries in each of the markets. And, you know, after I did that for, I don't know, maybe 9 months or a year or something like that, our VP of product at the time, Elliot, looked at me and said, "Hey, you know what? Maybe you should come and join the product team." And I, you know, I'd gotten a lot of the marketing stuff stable primarily by figuring out hacky ways to get an engineer to help me with something, and or to get one of the job board partners to, you know, give us access to some API that let us do something automatically. And so that was kind of my into product, was I slowly started, okay, I'm doing this thing. It's too much work for me to do. I'm going to start automating my own work. As I automate my own work, you know, then, oh, now I'm working more closely with the engineering team. I'm working more closely with the product team. And it just became a natural fit for me to hop over and become a product manager.
Gotcha. And so then what happens when you decide to leave the product team and you decide to leave Instacart? What was going into your mind to make that decision?
Yeah, you know, it was really about remembering why I had come in the first place. And, you know, if you think back to the earlier part of the story, the reason I went was to learn how real companies build real products. And I got to the point where I'd had time as an individual contributor PM. I'd gotten a couple of years of management experience managing a team of PMs. And I just deeply loved the people I was working with and felt passionate about the work I was doing. Ultimately, my job became, I was the director of product for Shoppers and Marketplace. So I found a lot of personal meaning in helping to bring on more shoppers and provide these flexible earning opportunities for people. But it had also been an incredibly grueling and draining 6 years. And I thought back and really remembered, you know, the reason I got into this was to learn how to do this stuff and what it looks like for, you know, to see a great company be built. And I feel like I've gotten that now. I know, not, you know, in all contexts by any mean, but I know a little bit about what that looks like. And I think I know enough where I owe it to my 6 year ago self to leave and do my own thing.
And what does that own thing look like?
Yeah. You know, I'm a real believer in trying out a bunch of stuff and seeing which paths develop and what sticks and, you know, how things evolve. And so I left with one really explicit goal, which is I wanted to build a cabin. It was a project I'd been talking about with my dad for many years. I also had a kind of early childhood interest in becoming an architect until I learned that you had to go to like 10 years of school and apprenticeships for that. And then I said, okay, maybe not. But I still had a real interest in architecture and in building. And that was my first plan, was actually to leave in May of 2020 and go build a cabin in the woods. And then, you know, COVID hit, and like everyone else, my life changed. All of a sudden, you know, the week before I was announcing to the company that I was leaving in May, you know, in March, we suddenly, Instacart, you know, just blew up and everybody wanted groceries online and nobody was leaving their homes. And we sure needed a whole lot more shoppers very quickly. And also it was this incredible opportunity to, you know, help hundreds of thousands of people who had just lost their jobs find a new way to work. And so I said, okay, I'll stick around. Yeah, I'm going to stay through for another 6 months and help make sure that we solve this problem. And I agreed to do that, but with the really explicit plan that, okay, when I leave, I'm building my cabin and I'm going to try some other stuff out. So, you know, I ended up, I've made good on the cabin promise. We've got this property that I'm at right now. We're on 28 acres here in the Texas Hill Country. I'm sitting in the first creator cabin. And we've got the second one, which is a new cabin being constructed out of shipping containers. All the infrastructure is in place up the hill. The cabins themselves or the shipping containers are being completed right now in California. They'll be delivered in just under 2 weeks. And then we'll be able to open up this place, which is a place for remote workers to come together in a community of remote cabins and, you know, figure out not only how to build their own independent online businesses, but also meet, you know, other folks doing the same thing in a beautiful natural place. So that's my big project. And then, you know, because I like to take a lot of little bets, I'm also doing some angel investing. I'm starting a fellowship for creators. I'm running the Carrot Angels Syndicate, which is an investment syndicate for Instacart alumni and employees. I'm exploring a couple different things, but the real core of it is the creator economy, because I believe that in the same way that I found a lot of personal passion in helping people make their first money independently online as Instacart shoppers, I think the creator economy is the next big opportunity to help an order of magnitude more people create not just make money online, but create a personal monopoly online.
Where did you get this idea that creators are part of the future in such a big way?
So I've been thinking a lot about the future of work in the context of Instacart. And particularly as we were designing products for shoppers, it was so clear that the reduction in transaction costs was really going to change the nature of the firm, which that was a very jargony technical sentence, but let me unpack it for a second. There's a guy named Ronald Coase, and Ronald Coase won a Nobel Prize for his work on something called the nature of the firm, which was this idea that traditional economics didn't really explain why companies existed. And if you look at sort of traditional economic theory, which is based on these frictionless transaction costs, then there shouldn't be companies. Everybody should just be independent contractors, you know, interacting with each other, because it's very easy to make contracts between people. But the reality is, it's actually not easy to make contracts between people. It wasn't when he wrote this paper in the 70s. It was very hard. And so as a result, companies pool together resources so that they don't have to constantly be making all these contracts between all the individuals. The fascinating thing, though, is that we are now in a world where there are frictionless transaction costs, where you can set up software so that, you know, if you're an Instacart shopper or an Uber driver or something like that, you can pull up your phone, open it up, and you can get offers for units of work, and you can see how much you're going to get paid and what the work is. And with one button, you can either accept it or reject it. Right. And that is pretty much frictionless contracts. And so I saw that and thought, man, this is so cool that this is a way that's going to empower people to make money independently online. But the problem with it is that you're not unique when you're on these platforms, right? It can be a great way for people to make money and particularly to make cash they need really quickly. But it doesn't allow you to build a personal brand. It doesn't allow you to differentiate yourself. And so when I started spending more time on Twitter and took Rite of Passage with David Perel and met a lot of online creators, I started realizing, yes, this is the thing, right? This is the thing that's going to let people take these tools that are developing to make it easier to transact and be your own boss online and allow people to create a lot of value from that.
In doing research for the conversation, it seemed like, I think from your perspective, you were naive when first starting at Instacart because you believed that the creator economy, what creators are doing, like David Perel, would be what Insta shoppers would be doing?
That is a great question. I was definitely naive when I joined Instacart, but frankly, I think we all were. I think the gig economy was, right? This was a new industry. There was very little regulation. And, you know, unless you're an economist that can really think through all of the sort of complex ways that these marketplaces develop, it was easy to look at the gig economy and say, wow, this is the future and this is going to be incredible for people. And for, you know, I stand by the work that I did at Instacart and the work that my former colleagues continue to do. I think there is an incredible amount of value generated by the gig economy for consumers and for shoppers and drivers and everyone else on the platform. I mean, it is a new, it's the first wave of, you know, the ability for millions of people to say, you know what, I don't want a boss. I want to work when I want to work. I want to work how I want to work. And it requires iterations. It's going to require, you know, various forms of regulation to make sure that it's a really good marketplace for everyone involved. But, you know, I think we were all naive about it because it showed so much potential. And I do think that, you know, the creator economy is going to be the next wave that unlocks even more of this sort of flexibility and independence for people. And we're okay, probably so naive about, you know, the creator economy as well.
That's exactly what I was going to say. So how do we not be naive? What are some of the mistakes that you saw in being naive the first time that you can apply to the creator economy and say, okay, that's where we're falling short?
Yeah. You know, I believe that appropriate doses of naivety and optimism can be a real advantage. And so I don't want to overcorrect here, right? I was talking to one of my my mentors from Instacart, a guy named Ravi Gupta, who was our CFO and COO. He's now at Sequoia and had just the smartest and most genuine human, certainly one of them that I've ever met and had the privilege to work with. And I was talking to Ravi recently and, you know, I was mentioning something about this, about how I was feeling like, you know, I had been sort of naive about this. And I wondered if the same thing was happening now. And he said, look, your naivety was why you were able to do what you did, right? If you aren't willing to be an optimist, then you're never going to accomplish anything. And I think that one of the kind of downsides of the kind of Twitter environment, and this seems to be changing a little bit, I'm seeing more optimism on Twitter than I feel like I used to. But, you know, one of the downsides of that is you just miss all the good opportunities because you don't believe anything is going to be good. And so I'm a real believer in believing. And I think that, yes, we have to acknowledge that we are naive about these things, but I'd rather be naive and, you know, hit the 80% mark than just never try in the first place. So I'm not going to lose my optimism for the creator economy. But I do think it's a good question to ask, you know, how can we make sure that we're setting this up in the right way? And I think that the big lesson to be learned, at least for me, is maybe that it's important that you have dynamics in place that provide leverage to the individual, and that you set up marketplaces in a way where, you know, individuals have options. And I think this is what's exciting about the creator economy, is that creators are really taking that to heart. They're not getting stuck to one platform or even one monetization structure. And I think that type of diversity, that type of, you know, the willingness to say, okay, I'm going to have several income streams. I'm going to have my own email list. I'm going to be able to move from platform to platform. That sort of thing, I think, is going to be really important for creators in the next 10 years.
Where does your optimism come from?
Oh man, I don't know. I think, you know, I've always been an optimistic person. I think one of my former bosses told me that I was optimistic about long-term strategy and pessimistic about short-term execution. And I think that kind of summed it up. I think that's a good place to be, because you get to keep your head in the clouds, but you also get to kind of gut check yourself on a day-to-day basis and say, am I really making progress?
So, but was there ever in your childhood or when did it develop, any idea?
Yeah, it's a good question. You know, I should probably spend some more time pondering that. But I think I come from a family of optimists. You know, I was talking a little earlier about my dad and his family growing up all over the world, and you know, you just don't you don't grow up in places like the Congo and, you know, India in the 50s and 60s and have the ability to kind of like leave everything behind and start over without being willing to have a lightness of approach, because otherwise I think things can get pretty grim. And I really picked that up from my grandparents and my parents, that if you just put faith into other people and into the future and into the ability for the long arc of moral progress, to bend towards justice and for technology to continue to evolve in interesting ways. As long as you put some checks on that, that's going to be a much more successful long-term strategy than just being a downer about things.
It's really interesting because that could explain the United States' prosperity over the last 100 years. If you look at it as a land of immigrants, people who had to get up and leave from where they were to where they were going to be, they had to think about the future being somewhat brighter than it was in this moment. And if you take that and their children's DNA to a land of prosperity and thinking about that in technological sense, you all of a sudden have people who are creating prosperity.
Danny, I absolutely love that. And I think it's so true. I think it's become only more clear over the past 4 or 5 years, as there's been this sort of nativist push in America, that immigrants really are at the core of the American story and what has made America actually great. I certainly am a believer in that. And I also think that ties into the creator economy. Lee Jin has written some really interesting stuff, and I've riffed on some of it about the creator middle class and how the last century of America, you had these incredible groups of people immigrating from all over the world, and you also had access to financial structures that allowed people to pursue the American dream, to get a 30-year fixed rate mortgage for a home. And I think that's part of what we need for the 21st century is these new funding models that allow people to leave their stable income jobs and have the ability to go out and build towards this new American dream and create this new American middle class, which I believe will be in part fueled by the creator economy.
And that's what the Creator Fellowship aims to do, right? So what is that all about? What is the process for getting a fellowship? And what are some of the examples, or an example that you could draw from that you've actually executed this model on?
Yeah. I'm a real believer in these sort of innovative funding models for the creator economy. And I think there's a range of them that are going to be very interesting that are explicitly not venture capital. Venture capital is great for what it's great for. But what it's great for is taking companies that have a very small chance of creating a whole lot of economic value and pouring money into them and having one in 10 work and the other 9 blow up. And that's not a model that's going to work for individual people trying to build a lifestyle in the creator economy. They don't have 9 lives to spare. and so, I think there are these other funding models that are going to become really important for the creator economy to take off. There's a woman named Carlota Perez, who has written about the different phases of technological revolutions. And she talks about this sort of S curve. And if you look at, she provides historical examples from the kind of industrial revolution and the age of oil and automobiles and electricity and trains. And all these things have this S curve where there's a big explosion at the beginning and you need funding models that look a lot like venture capital. And then at some point it goes from being a technology that's new and exciting to something that is pervasive, is everywhere in the economy. And when technology makes that transition, you need different kinds of funding models. You don't need the venture capital as much. What you need is production capital, things that can help the sustaining innovation, you know, as these new technologies are deployed to the whole economy. And I think that's exactly where we are in the internet revolution. And I think that a couple examples of funding models that are going to become really important are revenue-based financing. You know, basically using current revenue or subscription future revenue to get financing in some creative ways. Pipe is doing some cool stuff here with subscription revenue, or you know, just actual revenue, just funding your business with cash from customers, which is the best possible outcome, right? I think there's also, you know, kind of one spot further on the spectrum. There are things like shared income agreements, things that are sort of in this space in between debt and equity financing that have not been explored much because they don't fit within traditional models of funding, but are actually very cool ways that I believe the creator economy can flourish. And so to put my money where my mouth is, I started something called the Creator Fellowship, which is an income sharing agreement. So an income sharing agreement, which are already used in some educational contexts and even some other contexts like minor league baseball. The way that they work is, you know, you get some amount of money upfront and then you pay back a percentage of your earnings over some period of time. So for the Creator Fellowship, for our example, we give you $20,000 over the course of a year to cover all of your basic living expenses and give you the ability to quit your job and create full time. And we also provide support and mentorship and community as you do that. And in exchange, you share 20% of your earnings above $20,000 for 5 years, capped at 3x the initial investment. I know that's a mouthful. All of those components are in place to protect the creator, to make sure that the creator is making enough money on their own before they start paying back, and that the ISA payback is capped both in terms of time and in terms of the total amount of the payback. And if you look at ISAs, if you're interested in that model, you really should understand those dynamics and make sure that you know you're getting a deal that is fair and capped. But if you do that, then what's really cool about income sharing agreements is they create these really strongly aligned incentives. They make it so that the person investing in you only makes money if you make money. And if you don't make money, then you get to walk away debt-free. And I think that the combination of those two things, the incentive alignment and the ability to walk away if it doesn't work out, make the income sharing model pretty compelling for the creator economy. There's also a lot of other stuff out there, right? There's cool crowdfunding models. There's cool stuff happening in crypto. But that's the one where I think, you know, there's probably a whole lot of opportunity to fund more creators and get more people to take that leap.
And you've actually done this, right?
Yes, I have. So, yeah, the example I love sharing here is David Vargas. He is a creator who I met who was working at a software company. He's a software engineer, and he was kind of fresh out of college, started this job, and kind of similar to my experience, was like, wow, this is really not what I want for my life. So he started the Creator Fellowship, quit his job, started building open source extensions for Rome Research, which is this very cool note-taking tool that has the ability to build software on top of it. And very quickly, David gained a following within the Rome community and started providing a lot of value and, you know, is now making a lot of money. And he is on track to, he's about 6 months in right now, and he's on track to start, you know, paying back the fellowship and is even starting to make investments in, you know, kind of some longer term business opportunities. So, you know, I think David is an incredibly special person and example, but I also think he is an example of the type of thing we're going to see a lot more of, because if you have the skills to make a newsletter or to make open source software or to make an online course, you know, that is a very compelling path where within a year you can either start getting to the point where it's clear that you're going to be able to support yourself financially, or you can look at it and say, okay, this isn't for me, and you know, go back to a more traditional job.
I want to touch on the creator cabins. And I know we spoke about it briefly before, but I'd love for you to expand on what that vision is and how that aligns with everything else we've been talking about.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, I think 2020 was obviously the year of online interactions, right? It was this breakout moment for courses and for people to get together online in a way that they hadn't before because they couldn't get together in person. And that's all really valuable. I don't think it's going away. But I do think that what's going to be even cooler is when people can meet each other online and then get together in person. Because there's obviously still a lot of advantages of you know, being IRL. You can actually interact in a higher bandwidth way with people and eat a meal and, you know, do whatever. And so what gets me really excited is that I think the previous generation of social networks like Facebook were about making online connections with people that you already knew in person. And I think what we're going to see a whole lot more of is the opposite, meeting people online and then coming together in person. And that's what Creator Cabins is all about. It's a space for you know, people to get together and meet other like-minded people from, you know, our little corner of the internet. And you know, I think that having those sort of in-person communities is going to be incredibly valuable. I hope that it provides a place where people can, you know, have the space out here in beautiful nature to really focus on what they're building and to, you know, really dive into their creating, but also to meet other like-minded people and to share that experience with them. And ultimately, you know, let you in on a little secret. My long-term plan here is that I'd love to open up a whole lot more places like this. And I'd love to start planting the seeds of a sort of decentralized city, because I believe that, you know, along the same lines of the Facebook analogy, right now cities are the place where people go to get together because that's where all the other people are. And that doesn't have to be the case in the future, because now we have the internet and now we can get together with those people anywhere. And so what I'd love to see is, you know, to have not just Creator Cabins, but hopefully lots of other folks too, starting these little communities that can be anywhere in the world and have it be really easy for people to travel between them and to have this sort of decentralized city experience where what matters is the community that you're with. And then you can be with that community in a lot of different places.
Have you listened to Tim Ferriss's podcast with Balaji, I believe his name is?
You know, it's sitting in my inbox right now. I've seen so many people tweeting about it that I've got it queued up for you know, my next thing to listen to, but I haven't yet. But it sounds like I definitely should.
Yeah, well, this conversation that we've just had is the perfect complementary to what Balaji's talked about in so many different instances, in just creation, gig economy, and helping people go from cities and making those cities in real life and being started on the internet. It's like you are manifesting that. And it's so crazy. If you have enjoyed this conversation, for anyone listening and enjoyed this one, you'll also enjoy Balaji and Tim Ferriss. Lastly, before we wrap up, I want to ask, in doing research for this conversation, you mentioned that advice you would give to yourself when you were younger was, you know, you were extremely goal oriented and you would tell yourself to become more chill, basically. And you said you've become this way, but I'm curious, like, how do you think you've gotten to this point of being more relaxed about life and being more easygoing? I'm just making up words, but if those are accurate, feel free to expand.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's a good question. You know, I don't, it's a little bit hard to give advice about this because There's a certain survivorship bias here where, I acknowledge that part of the reason why I've had some of the success I've had was because I was willing to just grind. And I actually think that, in some ways your 20s are a great time to just grind and just make it happen and to just, figure out what you want and then really just go after it with everything you've got, because never again in your life will you have the drive and flexibility. And, now when I think about a 12-hour day of staring at the status page, I'm like, man, I gotta do some stretching and yoga in there somewhere. Like, I just can't even physically pull that off. And so I think, when you don't have kids and, have that sort of ability to just dive deeply into things, I think I'm not going to tell anyone not to do that, because I did, and I'm very glad that I did. But I also think that some people get their brains too programmed to keep doing that, and they don't stop. And I think what I saw a lot of in the tech world was people 5 or 10 years ahead of me in their careers who were still doing the same thing. And I'm sure they're making lots of money, whatever, but they're just stuck in this game that they don't need to be playing anymore. And I think that at some point, a lot of those people get into their late 30s, early 40s, and that's where midlife crises come from, is people, doing this for decades and then looking up one day and saying, holy shit, what have I been doing for the past, 10 years? And so I think what's really important is not to stop your ambitions, but to reflect on what you actually want and to make sure that the things you're doing are things you're doing because you want them and not because there's some, societal value perceived in doing them. Paul Graham has a great essay about this where he says, if you have two options that you're choosing between for your career, pick the less ambitious one, or not less ambitious, but less perceived ambition, right? When society says this is the thing you should do the other thing, because you're being brainwashed, right, into thinking you want things that you may not want. And so I've found that to be, probably my biggest personal breakthrough of my 20s was stepping back and saying, look, this has been great, but I don't want to keep doing this for another decade. I want to go try something different. And I would definitely recommend that people, whether you get that through therapy or meditation or going on a crazy around the world trip or whatever helps. I think it's worth having a good midlife crisis every 3 to 4 years to avoid, saving it all up until you're in your 40s.
So that's a great line. But what was it for you? Was it meditation, therapy, around the world trip? How did you get to that point?
All of the above. Yeah. I had a moment at Instacart where another one of my great mentors and bosses, David Hahn, an incredible product leader, looked at me one day and said, dude, you are burned out. You need to go sit on a beach somewhere for a month at now. And I did. I flew to Thailand, went to the most remote island I could get to, and I just sat there, thought about what I wanted to do with my life. And actually, that's where the idea for Creator Cabins first came from, right? Was sitting on this little island in Thailand. And I think that sort of personal reflection is the only way that you can really figure out what you should be doing with your life and why. What unique thing you can bring to the world.
I think that's a beautiful, beautiful place to wrap it up. Where can people find more from you, Jonathan? Where can you direct the people who want more from you?
Yeah, thank you so much, Danny. This has been a lovely conversation. If you go to johnhillis.com, johnhillis.com, that links to all my projects and stuff that I'm working on.
Awesome. Well, thank you for taking the time. Thank you for the wisdom. And I appreciate you tremendously.
Yeah, thank you so much, man. This has been a lot of fun.
I hope you guys enjoyed the episode with Jonathan Hillis. If you have any thoughts or feedback about the episode, let me know on Twitter at HeyDannyMiranda. You can also expect new episodes of the podcast Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. Thank you from the bottom of my heart for listening until the final seconds. It means the world to me. And if you enjoyed the episode, please share it with a friend. That's all for me, and I'll see you guys in the next one. Peace.